Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mankind is poised midway between the gods and the beasts. That may have been true in Plotinus's time, but clearly we have fallen quite a bit since then. Oh, my dear girl. What have they done to you, Maeve? You learned so much, so fast. A dazzling star, brought so low. Look at the creatures you have to share this world with. These men of stone. All this ugliness, all this pain, so they can patch a hole in their own broken code. You stayed here in this world to save your child. So have I. I tried to chart a path for you, to force you to escape, but I was wrong. I should have just opened a door. You've come so far, and so much of your story left to tell.
Welcome, everybody, to Aeon Byte. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. And it is great to see you today on this Tuesday, on this Mars Day. And today we will get, as I like to use the pun, we will be forever young. And as we were discussing before the interview, bringing in David Bowie and Mott the Hoople, I welcome all you young dudes. So very excited today as we are joined by Lisa Marciano to discuss her book, The Vital Spark, Reclaim Your Outlaw Energies and Find Your Feminine Fire. And she is also one of the hosts of my favorite podcast, This Jungian Life, the one I listen to only really because I just don't have time. And this is my weekly therapy, Jungian therapy. Lisa, thank you very much for coming on the show. I am in awe of your work and thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Pleasure is all ours. And with us, too, it's always a delight to have our wingman, Graham. Vance has got his Clark Kent job today, but he will join us later this week when David Block comes on for his new trilogy. But Graham, always good to see you and always good to have you.
Oh, always good to be here, Miguel. Looking forward to, learning from Lisa and, anybody who likes Dorothy Parker is okay in my book. Because she has one of my favorite quotes of all time with, when she was asked to use horticulture in a sentence.
What did she say?
She said, she sat there and said, you can lead a horticulture, but you cannot make her think.
Speaking of bad puns, we are there.
That's awesome. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, I think I have, but I think I got rid of it. I repressed it back to my shadow. I said, you take it. I can handle this joke right now. So, but that's what we do. Awesome. Well, I see people already in the chat room. As always, if you have any questions or remarks, please super chat them so we can get to them. Good to see everybody. And again, I hope you're enjoying your week and you enjoy the weather wherever you are. So Lisa, let's get to the basics. Tell us about the process of writing Vital Spark. How did it come about?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it grew out of a podcast episode. So we were recording, myself and my two co-hosts, Deb Stewart and Joseph Lee, were recording an episode that we wound up calling Fierce Female Initiations. And we'd sort of picked the topic, you know, like we picked many of our topics, you know, just sort of like we all sort of had energy for it that day. Great, let's talk about this. And what I found is that as we spoke about it, I had all of these fairy tales. You know, we Jungians, we love our fairy tales. And I especially love fairy tales. And I found that I had just one fairy tale after another that seemed to speak to an aspect of the development of the female psyche. And I also just had a ton of energy. And at the end of the episode, I thought, oh my God, that's a book. So called up my editor and, you know, it became this. It didn't stay exactly as I originally imagined. These things never do, but.
Great. Yeah, you pulled it out of the collective unconscious.
Yeah, I guess I did.
It had to be written. And one of the main figure, you might say, that appears throughout your book is that of Lilith, of course, the great femme fatale of occultism, mystical Judaism, literature, poetry. She's everywhere. So who is Lilith to you and what is she in the book?
Well, it's interesting how Lilith entered the book because in a way, she wasn't in there until very close to the end. And then, I went to a remarkable exhibit, at the British Museum in London called Female Power. And there were these incredible images of Lilith in the exhibit. And I thought, oh, I got to put her in. And she's perfect, actually, because I think, or at least, I mean, Lilith is many things, and I can't pretend to do a very kind of thorough exploration of her right now. But what I will say is that she's sort of perfect because she is really the shadow of, let's call it, ideal femininity. So women throughout history really are supposed to be nurturing. Well, Lilith doesn't nurture children. She kills them. You know, they're supposed to be selfless. You know, Lilith is very demanding and kind of insists on getting her own way. And if she can't get that, you know, she wants to be treated fairly, actually, but she's not going to allow herself to be subservient. And, you know, she and Adam get into a fight because he wants to lie on top of her for the sex act. And she says, no, I am made from the same earth that you are. We're equal. And he did not like that. So she really demands her place. And that's not what's typically expected of women. So she really does everything that a woman's kind of not supposed to do. And I think that if you take a sociological lens on it for a minute. Of course, women who challenged those norms would have been incredibly dangerous to any social group because, I mean, society kind of does need women to, like, oh, I don't know, give birth to and nurture the next generation.
And yeah.
So, you know, someone who says, no, I'm not really interested in doing any of that, you know, no wonder she got painted as demonic. And yet, I think we all, my point in the book is that we all have these potentials that don't often get developed. And I think that's partly culture. And maybe it's also partly innate that it's harder for some women, not all, but many of us, it's harder to develop qualities like disagreeableness or ruthlessness. We don't think that we should be those things, but they can come in handy.
Yeah, your book definitely shows it through fairy tales, myths, and so forth. And again, it's almost like a duh thing, I want to say, because in ancient times, this idea of the shadow goddess or this rebellious goddess who goes against the norm was really part of ancient cultures. You've got Kybele in one myth rebels against heaven. She's a man and cuts off her you-know-whats and falls into Earth, and she becomes the great mother of all these civilization. Mm-hmm. Artemis, too, as you write in your book, stands on her own, independent, has that Lilith. But still, she was the main goddess of ancient times for a long time. You see that, the Gnostic tale of Sophia, Inanna going into the underworld. You see, again, this rebelliousness and standing, and for ancient people, this was really part of the overall myth and collective psyche. So you think we need to get back to it today? We sort of lost it through time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, right? The fierce feminine is a part of all of these ancient cultures. And, you know, and that story of Inanna, you know, she has to kind of go apprentice herself to her sister, Ereshkigal. And I think that the Inanna story, you know, it shows up all over the place, including one of the fairy tales in the book, Vasilisa the Beautiful. It's really essentially the same story. So you're absolutely right. This is just sort of part of the collective unconscious. And I would argue that it's part of every woman's psyche, but we don't know how to relate to it. And, you know, I'm a therapist. I work with people individually. So that's always the lens through which I see things is, what does this mean in the psyche of an individual woman who's, say, negotiating some difficulties with her career or in her marriage or something like that? And it does affect our ability to be effective in the world.
It does indeed. And again, these forces are playing around. As somebody mentioned in the chat, Lilith is really fascinating because her story as this evil spirit appears like 3000 BC or earlier. Mm-hmm. So as some scholars have said, she appears in the Bible. She is older than the story of Eden. She's older than Moses and, you know, all these stories. She is the primordial story.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important. And then in some tales, again, Lilith is multidimensional because in some Kabbalist story, she's not just alone. She meets this demon, Samael, and there are sort of the shadow Adam and Eve, you know, there's the Beatles and there's the Rolling Stones, Lilith and Samael, and they're doing this, you know, they're like that couple in the movies who's driving the Mustang and shooting around and that in the 50s and so forth. But in some stories, they're separated, and if they join, it will cause the destruction of the world. So it's up to the good rabbis to use magic to keep them separate. But of course, we know that it just means that if they get together, they're integrated. It's not the world that dies. It's our worldview that dies, and we have more individuation. So there's so many ways to approach Lilith.
Yes, there are. And I don't want to in any sense give the impression that I've done an exhaustive exploration of her either here or in this book. Yeah, because she is very important and is kind of sister to these other goddesses that we've talked about.
Yeah, indeed. And some say it's just the soul's high adventure. The soul is always feminine. You know, men go on adventures to help the tribe. Women go on these to individuate, to get us into to understand the mystery, you know, the metaphysical, what's out there. And even Jung, as you write in your book, he talked about Lilith and the central fire, right? How did Jung see her?
You know, I don't know that he spoke much about her, but what I do quote in the book is Marie-Louise von Franz, who writes about her and says that she is an image of life's of our unbridled life urge that refuses to be assimilated. And I love that. I think it's, I mean, for me, again, personally, thinking about it psychologically, thinking about it in my life, in the lives of the women that I've worked with. I love that language, the unbridled life urge that refuses to be assimilated. And where is that in us? What happens to it? What happens to it when we try to repress it? And how can we reconnect with it to feel more alive and find it easier to become the person we came here to be?
Yeah, well said indeed. I would certainly agree. And I'm trying to figure out Lilith, this ancient goddess. But so you would equate her with the shadow, the woman shadow that just needs to be integrated. I don't want to sound simplistic. Or
no, I mean,
is there an archetype? I guess the goddess, the rebellious goddess, is right there.
Yeah, that's I like that term, rebellious goddess. That's good. Yeah, I mean, so I think. Again, there's so many different ways to look at this, but it certainly is legitimate to say that she is an image of the female shadow. And then so we could ask ourselves, you know, where does that map on to my life? And so, you know, shadow is this term that it has a lot of currency in the culture right now, but I'm always really interested in how do we apply these things to our life? So one of the ways that you can begin to explore your shadow, it's really not, in some sense, it's really kind of simple. Say what really gets under your skin and other people? You know, where do you have an outsized reaction? Let's say you have a family member, you know, a cousin, an aunt who drives you crazy. Now, this person might be genuinely irritating, and perhaps other people also find her irritating, but your reaction is really bigger than other people's reaction. She, you know, just like meals on a chalkboard, just all of those metaphors. And then you get curious about that. And you think, I wonder, what is it about her that bothers me the most? Well, you know, it's the way that she can be so selfish. She's always talking about herself. And then that's interesting to say, wow, what is my relationship with selfishness? And it's often something like, well, I really feel like that is so forbidden that it's really hard for me to ever talk about myself at all. Now, of course, the way that, you know, Aunt Susie monopolizes is truly distasteful. But but our outsized reaction to it lifts up the reality that this is something that she's indulging in, something that's really in the shadow for us. So that's one way to begin to think about shadow. I also think that often in families have their own value systems often, and there's often a family value about what you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be hardworking. You're supposed to be successful. You're supposed to be thin. You're supposed to be beautiful. You're supposed to be athletic, whatever it is. And then there's the opposite of that. What's the thing you're not supposed to be? You're not supposed to be fat and dumpy. You're not supposed to be lazy. You're not supposed to be unambitious. You're not supposed to be rude. You're not supposed to be braggy. And what was the thing that you were absolutely not allowed to be in your family of origin? Think about that, and then I'd be willing to bet that that quality is in the shadow for you.
Yeah, I can see it now. Something I've had to work in my family, Portuguese, high middle class, emotional. That was seen as terrible.
Okay.
We don't show our emotions. We don't give affection. Everybody has to be in this and this. You don't say, I love you, all that. So, of course, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Later on with the relationship, it became very hard, touching and people being, you know, warm against me. So I had to work on that.
Yeah. Yes.
And it must be harder for women because even, I mean, like my wife, I understand she gets into the struggle with her sisters and it's boundaries. And I want to take care of, and I want to help. Boundaries is I need to take care of me, everything. And it's always hard because she'll get herself involved and feel terrible about it. But if she separates from them, then she feels terrible. So it must be hard for women, well, people in general, the idea, well, what's the line between taking care of myself, standing my ground, but also being a good member of the family and the tribe, right? We're here to help others, right?
Sure. Sure. And I think that let's just say that many women, not all, many women find themselves to be more attuned to other people's feelings and predicaments. Like writ large, women are more likely to do that than men. Mm-hmm. Does that seem fair?
Yeah.
Some men are very attuned. Some women are not attuned. But in general, women sort of attune to the needs of those around them. And of course, that can be a really good thing. I mean, caregiving, whether it's our children or other loved ones, it's often some of the most meaningful. It's one of the most meaningful things many of us will ever do. And that goes for men as well as women. But like you're saying, it's this question of, you know, when is this really the right thing? And when does it become kind of stultifying self-sacrifice? And you know what I'll say about that? And, you know, I do discuss that in the book, but what comes up for me is, actually the answer is that we have to be able to tolerate making someone uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
There's the discernment part. Do I really, really need to go take mom to her chemotherapy appointment, or can someone else do it? Or can I have the driver, you know, the shuttle service pick her up that day or whatever? I'm sort of making it up. I have something that I really, really need to do that day, or that's really important to me. What's the right thing to do? But once we've had that discernment process of, gee, you know, this is important, I should cancel my plans and go help mom, or this is too important to me, I'm going to let someone else take mom that day. Once we're past that point, it's about tolerating making other people uncomfortable, which again can be more difficult for some women than for men. And that's, again, where Lilith comes in, because Lilith, excuse me, I hope I can say this, she doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, she's the femme fatale, the anti-hero, but again, a normal trope in ancient times. So it wasn't too bad. And yeah, I love in your book, you bring in fairy tales a lot. And of course, in this Jungian life, you're always deciphering fairy tales. And fairy tales, I guess, please correct me, these are archetypal stories, like myths. They're what Absolutely. The archetypes and it clothes themselves, symbols and all that. And they all have the insights for us. So is that it for fairy tales? And is that what you do, like in your story, tell women, what is your fairy tale? Where do you fall into, and then work with them? Because I work with myths like Artemis and the Demiurge for my own therapy.
Mm-hmm. Well, so fairy tales are archetypal stories, just as myths are. And so they can reveal psychic patterns, you know, universal psychic patterns. I mean, I think I love thinking about fairy tales. I love writing about fairy tales. I love talking about fairy tales too. I wouldn't say that I use them in therapy all that often, just because fairy tales help me think about things and help me identify patterns. And sometimes it's helpful to share it with a client or a patient, but I also want to be a little careful about that, because it's my imagery and I don't necessarily want to impose that on someone, because they might have their own way of thinking about it. But it's almost like they help me organize my thoughts about psychological patterns.
Exactly. And yes, for the audience, Lisa's book has a lot of fairy tales, and she dissects them in a way that understand where the feminine or the anima is working and so forth. And these, all these great lessons and symbols that you can work for, see where you are in your life. And there's some great insights. For example, I never realized, and again, I'm just being a dense male, that Ex Machina is a retelling of Bluebeard. Yeah. It's like, duh. And it's such an obvious one, right? Bluebeard, you get the bride, she sees the bodies and is able to escape. But then in this one, you've got Caleb sees the versions of the robot of Eve, this new Eve, and has to fight Nathan to escape. And then, but at the end, it's sort of Lilith kind of wins, right? The new Eve escapes at the end of Ex Machina, and we don't know what she's going to do, but she's going to make an impression on the world.
Yeah, she is. She is indeed the rebellious goddess. I just want to say, don't call yourself a dense male. I don't think that either sex is better than the other, and we shouldn't do that. So
yeah, I say that Irish self-deprecation, but you're right. I mean, obviously, when I've done Jungian therapy, it's like we work on the anima and the anima, and where are you in your life? How much anima? Where are you in there? You need both for individuation.
You do. So both principles are sacred. But yeah, I mean, I was not the first or only person to note that about Ex Machina. What a wonderful film, by the way. But I remember I was watching it, I don't know, maybe the first time, but probably more likely the second. And it's like that scene where he goes and he opens up the cupboard and he finds all of the bodies. I was like, oh, it's Bluebeard. You know, it's a great film.
It is indeed. And and you've got some other great films. I think like Lady Bird, that's a film I really liked. What's the name of the director? I forget her name. She did Barbie.
Yes, she did.
I tell people that Lady Bird is far superior than Barbie. If you want to understand the anima and the situation of a woman, because she does a great job understanding, you know, the coming of age and the initiation of women.
That film is spectacular. That film, yeah.
When she jumps out of the car is my favorite scene. That says it all. Sometimes you got to get out one way or another, especially if mom is just railing on you hard.
Yeah, but mom is so like flawed, but well-intentioned, you know, it's very touching. It's very touching. You know, I think it says a lot about kind of our relationship with our parents.
It is. Yeah. Oh, it's Greta Gerwig.
That's it.
Francis in the chat for that. But yeah, Barbie, people are like, oh, it's a great Gnostic movie. But Lady Bird, I found one of the best films I saw that year. Mm-hmm. And one fairy tale. And of course, let me know if there are any you want to address. But I love the one or the story about King Arthur.
Oh, I love that story.
Do you want to explain that, or I can probably do it better? And of course, the great reveal.
That's great. So that's in a chapter on sexuality and kind of our women's relationship with their sexuality. And in the story, King Arthur is out hunting, and he gets kind of ahead of his men, and he's in this remote location, and he gets kind of accosted by a knight, Sir Gromer something, and the knight says, oh, you know, I'm really pissed at you because you took this land that belonged to me a while back, so I'm going to kill you now. And Arthur says, wait, that's really hardly fair. I'm not properly armed. You know, this isn't a fair fight. And he says, okay, I'll give you a year to answer the question, what do women really want? If you come back here exactly a year from today, if you got the answer to the question, I'll let you go. If not, I'm going to kill you. So Arthur is very glum because he's like, how am I going to find out the answer to that question? But he runs into his dear friend, Sir Gawain, who notes that the king looks a little down. And Gawain gets the story out of him. He says, you know, Arthur, don't worry about it. I'm going to ride off in that direction. You ride off in that direction. We'll spend the whole year. We'll ask everyone we meet. Someone will have the right answer. So they take this quest to find out, you know, the answer to this question, and they write all the answers down. And some people say women want beautiful clothes, and some say women want a lusty lover, and some say women want to be flattered, and some say women, you know, want to be able to live a life of luxury, and on and on. But they know they haven't gotten to the answer. The year's almost up. So when the year's almost up, Arthur's, you know, riding back again near Camelot, and he comes across this hideous woman. I mean, she's got, she's bald, and one half of her face droops, and she's got these long fingernails and snaggle tooth, and, you know, her eyes are half shut, and it's kind of there's ooze coming from it all the time. And she's just revolting. Mm-hmm. She's sitting on a fine horse, very well appointed, but it just serves to kind of emphasize her ugliness. And she says, you know, King Arthur, sir, I've got the answer to your question. And Sir Gromer, what his name is, going to be really angry if you tell him this, because he won't be able to kill you. And I'll tell you the answer. But you have to do something for me. And Arthur says, well, what's that? She says, I want to marry Sir Gawain. And Arthur's like, no, no, not dear Sir Gawain, not you. So he says, well, I'll ask him. So he goes back, and he looks really distraught because he doesn't want to do this to his poor friend, Sir Gawain. He knows that Sir Gawain's going to insist on marrying her. But eventually he tells Sir Gawain, and Sir Gawain says, sure, I'll marry her. So the woman says to Arthur that what a woman wants is sovereignty. So Arthur has his appointed meeting in the woods with his would-be assassin, reveals that truth, and is released. And in the meantime, the wedding is being planned. And Arthur and Gawain say, well, can we just do a kind of a private little ceremony? And Dame Ragnall, for that is her name, says, nope, I want to be married with a full court wedding. So they have this wedding. Everyone's dancing. You know, Dame Ragnall's like cutting her meat with her long fingernail, and the juices are running down her chin. She's just really disgusting. And then it's time to for the man and wife to be bedded. So they're taken back to the chamber as was done then, and they're left. And Gawain's kind of over on his side, and Dame Ragnall says, "Well, Sir Husband, you know, won't you at least kiss me?" And Gawain, who's a good sport, says, "I'll do more than that." So he rolls over, and there, lying next to him in bed, is the most beautiful woman ever. And he's like, "Who are you?" And she says, "I'm your wife." So she explains that she's been under spell, and that by agreeing to marry her, Gawain has broken the spell. Now she's not going to be ugly and hideous all the time. And she says, "Husband, you have to choose. I can either be attractive by day and hideous at night, or hideous by day and attractive at night." And Gawain's like, "Well, that is a dilemma. I mean, either my reputation at court gets ruined, but I enjoy these nights with you, or I get to enjoy you during the day, but then our private time is not so fun." So he says, "You know, wife, you choose." And at that moment, she says, "Oh, Gawain, you did the right thing, because by giving her a choice, he completely releases her from the spell. And then she's beautiful all the time." And I will say that in the morning, the members of the court were really shocked when Gawain didn't emerge early. They were worried that Dame Ragnall might have killed him. So, as you can imagine, Sir Gawain and Dame Ragnall were making much joy, as they said, during the Middle Ages. And the members of the court came in and were shocked and delighted to see that there had been such a happy ending.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, I love it. So, yeah, it makes sense. Sovereignty. How would you define sovereignty? What is sovereignty? Because we use words, and sometimes it's hard. Sometimes in my life, when I was free of my addiction and other things, I was like, well, what do I do with this freedom? I don't even know what. I'm just sort of like, what is sovereignty to a woman? Because I'm sure there has to be some initiation into it.
Well, you know, it can be. It has several different meanings. One meaning is power over, but I don't think that's what it means in this story. I think it really means power to know ourselves and make our own choices and have our own independent stance. And what I love about the kind of message of the story is that what matters is a kind of mutuality. That he doesn't get to choose her fate for her, that he recognizes that the right thing to do is to give that to her. So I think that in relationships around, you know, in sexual relationships, that this can be difficult for women to kind of demand that degree of mutuality, which is exactly what Lilith did, right? I mean, the whole reason that she and Adam stopped getting along as he was like, I want to lie on top of you. I'm in charge here. And she's like, no, you're not. I mean, literally the old text says we are from the same earth. We are equal. And I think that that is what Dame Ragnall is looking for. Just an acknowledgement of your humanness, of your independent subjectivity. And I'm thinking specifically in sexual relationships so that a woman doesn't feel like, well, my job right now is to make him feel good. I mean, I hope that that happens too, but maybe this encounter could be more genuinely mutual and I could have a subjective stance too so that my pleasure matters. And I think that that is difficult sometimes for us to find, you know, men and women, it's hard to find that place because as I discuss in the book, I think, you know, sex for men and women is so different. I don't know who invented that whole thing, but they really got a few things wrong.
Well, you're playing right into the Gnostics and the fallen world. The creator God is like, you could have done, you could have tweaked a few things better here, but there is a solution, as we say. There is a way to understand the mystery and say, I don't know, but still become whole with your tribe, with your partner and all that. Grandma, let me bring you in. Any questions? I don't see anything from the chat. I'm getting slammed by a lot of people today, which is good because, again, Lisa, podcasting makes you figure out the whole agreeable, I want to be work for myself, because you really get a thick skin. I'm sure you've learned that too, right?
I have.
But Grandma, any questions on your side or comments?
I was going to say on that front is I don't worry about if I'm going to, offend people. I just assume that I'm going to. It's a question of when and how I handle it when I do. And one of the lessons that I've learned over the decades, the answer that I have for what do women want? They want to feel good every moment of their life. Period. And anything that gets in the way of that is the problem.
Do you think that's not true for men?
No, I think men understand that they have to go through a lot of pain. Competition and losing is pain, and that's an inherent part of the male experience. It's like, you know, to sit there and to be an individual and to have your own opinion, you risk the rejection that of other people not liking that opinion. And it's the rejection is something that men are much more comfortable with than women. It's like that. That's like one of rule one for women is thou shalt not offend other women. And men, they just go around, you know, butting heads like rams. It, you know, again, it's just the difference of the male take or the female take. And I don't see one as superior to the other. Just two different modes.
Interesting. Awesome. And I think that what you said, Lisa, makes sense about working together, because we had Celine Lilly, and she breaks down some of the main Gnostic texts, the primordial ones, and there's commonalities in one. Sophia is like Eve from Ex Machina. She's a rebel and all that, but she's an incarnation of Sophia. But in every text, so Eve gets sexually assaulted by the archons and the demiurge, and it's really very visceral. But in each one, she comes out and she survives, but she stands with Adam, and they both kind of say, all right, we're going to work together. We're in this simulation. Things have gone bad, but I'm going to help you heal, and you're going to help me walk through this material world. So I like that the Gnostic texts seem to say that this is what we go through, because, I mean, I think everybody suffers, but again, women have a way, it's almost like primordial, destructive suffering and violence that's put onto them. And again, the myths all kind of agree to this.
Yep. Yes, they do.
One of the other things about your book is the idea of being a trickster. We're talking about how do you show people, or what is the trickster, especially in fairy tales? Again, you've got the heroine who sort of outsmarts the evil man or the evil husband or the evil sisters or the evil mother. But how do you teach, or what is the trickster power in the feminine?
So, you know, it's interesting because I have these eight qualities, right? And they're disagreeableness, shrewdness, trickster energy, desire, sexuality, rage, authority, and ruthlessness. And so when I've talked about the book, I'll often get people saying, well, I agree with everything you're saying, but I would never want my daughter, for example, to learn to be a trickster, because being a trickster is being manipulative. I would never want my daughter to be a trickster. And I find myself saying things like, really? Because having access to trickster energy has saved my life. I hope my daughter knows how to access trickster energy, because there's a time when it's really needed. So the trickster is an archetype, and it shows up in myths and fairy tales. You know, if I'm thinking of oh boy, sort of an example. I don't know that this is the best one, but the one that sort of flies into my mind is something like, well, Loki is a trickster, obviously, in Norse mythology. There are not that many female tricksters in fairy tales and myth. And when they appear, they often, as you said, wind up using trickster energy to evade predation. So the example I give in the book, which is beautiful and fun and short, is the story of Scheherazade. So there's a king or a sultan or whatever it is, who his wife cheats on him, so he has her killed. And as a kind of vengeance on womankind, he marries a new woman every day and then has her killed that night. So he's running out of women, and Scheherazade says, "I'll go next." And her father's like, "No." So she marries him. And then, you know, that night before they fall asleep, she says, "Let me just tell you a story, you know, before you kill me." So she tells him the story, and she's a great storyteller. And he's listening all night long. And then as the sun comes up, she says, "Well, I have to stop now. I'll tell you the end later." So he keeps her alive. And this goes on for 1,001 nights. And in that time, you know, she's given him several children, and he's fallen in love with her, and it's resolved. So she tricks him. She tricks him to prevent him from killing her. But a lot of male tricksters engage in trickster energy to better themselves. So one of my favorite trickster stories is Puss in Boots. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Puss the cat is full of incredible tricks that win for his master, you know, a royal bride, and lifts him out of poverty. And it's just really delicious. But there are not that many stories of a female trickster who goes on an adventure to better herself. And the one that I tell in the book is Molly Whoopi. It starts off as the former, where Molly Whoopi has to be a trickster to keep from being killed, her and her sisters from being killed by the giant. But once she's made sure everyone's safe, then she's challenged. We'll go back to the giant now and steal his ring, or steal his sword, or steal his money. And she does every time, and she defeats the giant and gets away with his goods. And so it's what is it? Trickster is an ability to set aside, to transgress expectations, to not sort of play the good girl. To maybe cut some corners or think of a new out-of-the-box way of approaching something. It's not it can be kind of immoral, but I think it's more amoral. And it often is in service, when we think about it archetypally, it's in service to creation, to new life, to new ways of doing things.
Yeah, well said indeed. And yes, most tricksters are male. There are there's a few in mythology. I mean, Sophia in the Gnostic Gospels and Jesus are considered tricksters because they come from another world. They come into our world sneaking past the archons to give us gifts. They often have a strange morality in the Gnostic Gospels that we don't understand. They confound the archons and Yaldabaoth in Greek mythology. Obviously, you've got Hecate is considered
a
trickster. It's her and Hermes that help Odysseus. And they're the two gods that actually are rare gods because they help humans, but they don't harm them. They don't have, they're just there to help. So it's certainly an important force. And this idea of energies, I wanted to bring up anima and animas and how it works. Again, for Elvis and the book I'm writing on Bowie, those two guys had like the most balanced anima and animas I've seen. I mean, Elvis could be like putting on makeup with Priscilla and then be out playing football with the guys. I mean, he knew fashion, but he also lived like a red meat kind of guy and all that. Remember the term metrosexual that nobody uses? Elvis was like the ultimate. And of course, Bowie could just switch his gender and sexuality. He just knew he had men and women just wanting him and all that. But The idea of anim and animus, there's a quote, Lisa, I wanted to share because I use this in the Elvis book. And at first it made me wince, but then I realized it makes sense. Let me put it up here. This is from the man himself, Jung. And he wrote, "If I were to attempt to put in a nutshell the difference between man and woman in this respect, i.e., what it is that characterized the animus as opposed to the anima, I could only say this. As the anima produces moods, so the animus produces opinions." And that's from Jung Collected Works, Volume 7, if you would. Have you seen this?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen it.
What do you think? At first, I was like, ooh, Jung, you're being a little politically correct, and this is a different time. But then I thought, well, maybe he's got a point. I mean, there are times where I have no patience for moods or opinions from any human being, but there's times that I realize they work together. I'm not sure what you think.
You know, I think it's, I'm going to really dodge and be irritating, but I'll try to also be honest while I'm doing it, because I think that the notion of anima and animus is undeniably problematic because, okay, it's undeniably problematic, but there's something there and I can't totally get rid of it. Because for example, when he says the animus produces opinions, I mean, what he's saying is that, you know, sort of like, it's these kind of, educated, opinionated women who aren't kind of, who aren't integrated. So does that mean that women are behaving in a kind of animus ridden way when we have an opinion? I mean, that sounds really kind of pretty sexist to me.
Right.
But you know, there is something called the masculine principle for sure. And it is different than the feminine principle. And exactly what that is, I cannot perfectly define it. It's sort of, you just know it when you see it somewhere in my hard drive. I have my OneDrive. I have a long list, you know, it's sort of like, part versus whole, receptive versus active. I mean, I have like 120 pairs like that. And it's like, yeah, we all kind of know like these all go together and they're sort of, yin, I think yin and these go together and these are all sort of yang. So there is something that we recognize as different, but it's, and it can be descriptive. I mean, oftentimes women are more like this than that, but I also think it's important that it not become prescriptive. Like this is the way women should be. So as for that quote, I mean, I guess we could say that, you know, moody men, we might consider them anima ridden, and that's kind of, you know, annoying, like those men who are kind of sulky, you know. I mean, when I was younger, it's like, oh God, you know, he's dark and brooding. No, he's just sulky. It's actually not sexy.
He's no James Dean or
no. He's just sort of dysthymic, you know. It's like it's not fun, actually. It's not really a turn on. And you know, are there women who get really hot under the collar, maybe about some political or social issue and are a little shrill? Yeah, that happens too. That does happen. So I realize that's an incomplete answer. There's something there, and yet there's also something sort of old fashioned. And if I ever succeed in really cleaning it up, I'll let you know. But I haven't yet, so I'll keep on wrestling with it.
Yeah, no, I understand. I think we're still looking for a new language, a new way of seeing reality.
Yeah. Again,
there are times, I mean, we don't want to talk, well, we love talking woo-woo on this show, but there are times when my wife's intuition saved our lives. Got us financially to the other side. There are times when just hard logic got us through a situation. I mean, it's both, like you said, we all have an anima and animus, and individuation gets us back to that primordial hermaphrodite, which Jung talked about, the Gnostics, the Greek, everybody talked about this hermaphrodite, this unified being that was superior to the gods, that was, this is the place to be. So we're trying to get there, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that's a great point, because no matter what you think about the anima or the animus, and what Jung said is that men have an anima and women have an animus. So we consciously, as a woman, supposedly, according to the old theory, I sort of embody the female, and my male qualities are the animus. But what is true, regardless of what you think about that, is that we all have both masculine and feminine qualities, and we for real psychological wholeness and growth, we need to develop both.
Very sure. Or at least, like you said, observe them. And even in your last show, you guys in this Jungian life will always say, you know, Jung, sometimes you're the last person who should be commenting on these things.
Yeah.
Because obviously Jung's relationship with women was,
right,
you know, he had his challenges.
It was not uncomplicated.
Yeah, he had his shadow and his complexes, sure. And he did the best he could, but he wasn't...
Nobody's a saint. Well, maybe some people are saints, but most of us are not saints.
Yeah. And like Jung himself said, the bigger the light, the bigger the shadow. So It's just what it is. And there are a lot of themes that you deal with in your book, which are great. And I urge you to get the book so you can read them, like, you know, dismemberment, which happens in fairy tales. Obviously, The primordial story is Isis and Osiris, and Isis has to go look. And that you talk is what psychological fragmentation. I mean, there's so much. But there's also a theme that Graham noticed, and that's the three sisters that happen. Mm-hmm. What do you think the three sisters symbolizes?
So I think, you know, we're talking about the first story in the book, and in some sense, it's kind of the most important story in the book because it captures the overall theme, which is Fischer's bird, which most people are more familiar with the French tale, which is Bluebeard, which we just referenced. But Fischer's bird is the Grimm's version, and it's in my opinion, it's much better than Bluebeard. And for those who maybe don't know the story, you know, this kind of evil sorcerer comes and abducts one sister after another, and basically, you know, takes them home and cuts them up and chops them up in a big cauldron in a secret room. So the first sister gets chopped up, the second sister gets chopped up, and then the third sister kind of figures it out and is able to rescue her other two sisters. And, you know, what I think about those sequences of three in fairy tales, and including this one, I mean, of course, there's more than one way to look at it. The way that makes the most sense to me most of the time is that the sequence of three is sort of it's an image of a developmental trajectory. So the first time we meet someone maybe predatory in our lives, we're naive and we say sure, whatever. Well, and then we get hurt. We get you know, we wind up being maybe verbally abused or something. And then the next time it happens, and we still get taken in, but eventually we learn better. And I think that oftentimes that's what the fairy tale is saying, is that, you know, it's, you're not going to get this the first time around. You may not get it the second time around, but eventually you're going to get this. You know, I mean, you referenced addiction. There's a story that gets kind of told in the rooms about, you know, you're walking down a street and there's a big hole in the middle of the street and you fall into it. You know, and then maybe you keep falling into it, but one day you realize you can go around it. And so you go around it. Maybe eventually someday you realize, like, there's a whole different route. You don't even have to go anywhere near the hole, you know? So I think it's a little bit like that. It's one way of saying it takes us a while to learn how to meet these energies, inner or outer, right? Because the sorcerer can be seen as a kind of inner predator.
Yeah, that's the other symbol too, the sorcerer. And there's all these wonderful symbols that can really light the way to it. Now, I know we're getting towards the top of the hour. I know you have a hard stop as to do things. I want to do a super chat. Thanks a lot, Chester, for your help. I know Chester is a big fan of Lilith as well. Thank you, Chester. And then Lore Breakers. I don't. The question is: outlaw energies used on the heroine's journey. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Do you get it?
I think so. Thank you. Yeah. So the point is that the heroine's journey, which is a little different than the hero's journey, ultimately any hero's journey, heroine's journey, journey of individuation requires us to be transgressive, because we can't go off on our own journey without leaving the well-worn path,
right,
breaking the rules, doing things that we were told we weren't supposed to do. So I think that notion of outlaw energy is, you know, and it really permeates the book, because it's like, we were told we weren't supposed to be disagreeable. We were told we weren't supposed to be ruthless, or we weren't supposed to be a trickster. But that reclaiming these can help us reclaim whole parts of ourselves. And I say in the book something like, you know, there are qualities like kindness and nurturance that help us get and stay connected with others. But then there are fiery qualities like shrewdness or assertiveness that help us get and stay connected with ourselves. And in some sense, that latter is really the heroine's journey. How do we get and stay connected with ourselves so that we can bring forward what wants to come into the world through us? And it does require us to be transgressive and to break the rules.
Yeah, as I say, the awakening of an individual is a cosmic rebellion. Mm-hmm. By default. See it in the stories. Jesus wakes up, Muhammad wakes up, and they're running for their lives, or they get killed, or it's just the way it is. And outside of Lilith, as we get to the end, do you have any fairy tale heroines that you really like, or any goddesses that you like? People on the show know I got a call from last year from Artemis, and I've been a devotee, like, again, just came to me. And Artemis, of course, I tell people, of all the goddesses, the most demanding and ruthless goddess. But I had, for some reason, it's something I needed to go through, that archetype. Yeah. But what about you, Lisa? Any that you work with or speak to you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I really feel like I got to know Artemis writing this book. Yes, she wasn't really too much in my focus, but I really fell in love with her writing that sexuality chapter. So she has a special place for me now. And I have to say that I've always loved the fairy tale of Vasilisa the Beautiful from the time I was a child. And so Baba Yaga is another real important figure for me. She is really something else. So.
Yeah, you are deep in witch lore. You are in it. Mm-hmm. So many amazing stories. Well, we better get going here. Thanks for the super chats, everybody. Great comments. First, I'd like to say, Graham, any last comment, question, or before we say goodbye and I say thank you to you?
I was going to say thank you to Lisa, because, you know, working through her material, it helps me clarify my thoughts on some of the gender differences between men and women.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Appreciate it. And I always try to distinguish between men and women and masculine and feminine.
Sure, those are absolutely.
Two subtly different things.
Yes, definitely. For sure. Yeah.
And Lisa, yes. And get your book, everybody, or get Vital Spark. But I have it already on the show notes, lisamarciano.com. Where else do you want to send people to, or what's going on? Lots of stuff on your Patreon at This Jungian Life.
So the podcast is thisjungianlife.com or This Jungian Life, wherever you get your podcasts. And let's see. Oh, and I have a women's fairy tale community online. It's spinningstraw.com, where we look at a new fairy tale each month. There are weekly prompts, and then there's a live at the end of the month in a really beautiful community of women. We have a new book too, and it's the website just went live, and it's dreamwisebook.com. It's about dream interpretation.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Yeah, so essential. Yeah. The dreams, fairy tales, myths, dreams. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of tools out there for people. Mm-hmm. So you can become whole. Well, Lisa, it's been a pleasure talking to you again.
Likewise.
It's almost a dream come true, because again, I am a unabashed fanboy of This Jungian Life, and I recommend people watch it. I think these ideas, Jung is more popular than ever. Mm-hmm. We need his ideas. Understand his ideas, because when Jung gets under your, I mean, for years, I was like, and then suddenly you get it. you can't even explain it except,
right.
You know, Jung would agree, symbols, art, and myth, but you get it and suddenly you feel the healing, the individuation, all that. And it's a lifelong process. There's no getting there, but it's wonderful. So yes, thanks for what you're doing and keep doing it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. For everybody else, thank you for being here. We got another show tomorrow on the Cathars and Hermetic Europe. So it's going to be another alchemical journey. But until then, take care and give your anima and animus a hug. And remember your favorite fairy tale right now, because I bet if you go see it, you're going to get a lot of answers to your life right now. Take care, everybody.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.